I'm Al from New Zealand, who can just about buy that Hammer invented Turkish Delight, but just can't accept that Michael Ripper comes from anywhere near North Africa.
And I'm Steve from Maryland, who wishes he invested in Adam Beauchamp's anti-aging treatments because he definitely needed a hand by the end of this month's movie.
We are Hammerama, your podcast equivalents of Lara Croft and Henry Jones Jr., raiding tombs so that you don't have to.
Our title music is the wonderful theme to House of the Gorgon by the equally wonderful Reber Clark. And the ancient monument we are breaking into this time is Hammer's second visit to the land of the pharaohs, 1964's The Curse of the Mummy's Tomb.
Warning! Warning! Beware the curse of the mummy's tomb. The vultures are gathering for yet another feast. Beware, you infidels and unbelievers. Take heed of the curse. Do not meddle with the secrets of the dead.
I must take you into my confidence and warn you.
There is a curse which says that all persons present at the opening of a pharaoh's coffin and who gaze at the face of the mummy therein shall die. You have been warned.
You have been warned. You, Terence Morgan, beware. Your past may catch up with you. You, Ronald Howard, beware. Let the sleeping mummy lie. You, Fred Clark, beware. Let gold not be your god. And you, Jean Roland, beware the love of a handsome stranger. And all of you here now, beware the forbidden secrets of life and death.
You cannot run away from the curse of the mummy's tomb. We're all doomed to die for this act of desecration.
The curse of the mummy's tomb reveals the mystery. The murders. The terrifying story of a rampaging bandage and bone monster stalking those who defiled its tomb of terror.
In a startling departure to any mummy movie before or since, a mummified ancient Egyptian is revived to wreak vengeance on the ignorant Westerners who have disturbed his ancient rest. The wrathful, gotta roll in my R's, the wrathful, rapt revenant works. Yeah, you try saying that, listeners, real tough.
The wrathful, rapt revenant.
Perfect. Works his deadly way through the cast, including a faithful Egyptian servant who has tried to make the colonists understand the error of their ways. The events culminate with the mummy and our French-accented heroine waist-deep in water until she is rescued by an armed posse and he disappears beneath the surface, presumably to lament his typecasting and wonder if mummies will ever get to try musicals or rom-coms one day. And that's really the thing, man. Why aren't they getting musicals or rom-coms?
It's well past time. Keeps me awake at night, but I'm afraid this film doesn't.
Oh, I will say this, just because listeners are going to say this. There was a mummy. There is a movie where the mummy is in a musical. Mad Monster Party?
I was thinking of Mad Monster Party, actually. Yes, yes. First thoughts. This film sort of reminds me of the situation in the 1930s and 40s when you had other studios producing films in the vein of Universal horrors. And the intent was there, but the production values and the big names usually weren't. I mean, obviously this is still a Hammer production, but it's missing any of their usual repertory, except Michael Ripper in a supporting role, and at a stretch, George Pastel playing more or less exactly the same role as he did in The Mummy. But the lack of familiar faces in the lead roles gives this film a very disconnected feel for me, and it sort of comes off as feeling like Hammer in name only. But having said that, I'm a big fan of Jack Gwillim, an alternative Van Helsing from The Monster Squad, and Greek god Poseidon from Clash of the Titans. He's great, and the rest of the cast are perfectly good, but ultimately this just feels like a B picture. And sure enough, it was released as the supporting feature to The Gorgon. What are your first thoughts, Steve?
I'm going to say there's an interesting storyline, you know, as we find out some certain plot twist and that kind of stuff. And I'm always intrigued with this because people want to live forever. People are always like, oh, I wish I would never die. I wish I would never age, live forever, which we've had in the picture of Dorian Gray. You've had many, many books and movies talking about the negatives of it. And I thought that was interesting how it was brought up, how Adam, having lived thousands of years, and the torture is he cannot die. Unless it's by the hands of his brother. And I think that was an interesting take. And I wish they would have played more with that. You have done more with it. Because that could have been an interesting topic carried throughout the whole story. And I was thinking that that was what the story was missing. It was missing a through line. Because a lot of disjointed little parts put together. Story, like, it's a patchworked or wrapped up. Whatever you want to do. I mean, The Mummy has a big patch on him. So maybe it fits with this movie. there's good bones here and structure. I just think it could have been fleshed out more with the writing. The parts are dropped. But I really wish that the storyline about living an extended period of time, knowing you could never die, and how that is such a curse, going into the pathos of that character, that I think could have been played up more than showing up near the end of the movie.
You cannot die, MacLeod. Yes, I think Christopher Lambert probably knows what that feels like. But that is a very good point, Steve, that the curse is actually not being able to die. But as you say, that whole thing about Adam comes out of left field a little bit. I wish it had been sewn throughout the rest of the film a little more skillfully. And one thing that I would like to see is perhaps some subtle indication that Adam is invoking some sort of mystic influence over Annette, because her fickleness and the ease with which she becomes attracted to another man, leaving her poor fiancé completely out in the cold, makes her a difficult character to understand and like. And if there was perhaps some hint that Adam is employing some sort of magic to lure her away, that would give a subtle hint that there's more to him than meets the eye, and also maybe explain her pretty inexplicable behavior.
I agree with that. And also the behavior of the mummy when reacting to her. Like you see the scene where he's touching her hand so gently when she's unconscious, and then how he does not try to kill her at all at the end. It's not established or anything. So I think, again, if they would establish that maybe she's a reincarnate, you know, which has been done, oh my Lord, to death, but.
Or maybe he just likes the ladies.
That's true.
Good-looking guy that he is.
Because he's all wrapped up head to toe. I mean, it's just, it keeps that complexion perfect.
It did sort of make me wonder how Hammer could go from a beautifully realized mummy in the form of Christopher Lee to a mummy that was obviously prepared by not even the B team in ancient Egypt, but maybe the C team, the backstreet guys who were doing a really quick mummification job on the side. Because, yeah, when they did Monster Squad, One thing that I really enjoyed, because it gave people with my particular body type hope that they could find roles in films, is that they found an extremely thin person and bandaged him up to be the mummy. But in this situation, you've got what is already a fairly substantially built person. Then having bandages wrapped around him, he actually starts to look a bit more like a snowman than what you would imagine an Egyptian mummy to look like. They've been doing that since Lon Chaney Jr.
So you're saying he's more like the Michelin man?
I would never say such a thing, Steve.
You'd only imply it, but I mean, you know, it's...
Stay puffed face, you.
Yeah, not everybody has the physique of Doug Jones and can pull off these roles that he's so talented at doing.
Doug Jones is another good example. Anyway, shall we talk about our favorite scene?
Sure. You want me to go first? You know, I have a tendency to steal from you.
That's okay. I do have one in reserve because I know that you're always going to do that. So you go.
I think my favorite scene or scenes involve Jack Willen, as you said earlier, you know, Sir Giles, and his acting ability of a broken man, and how you see that on the ship where he's bad from Egypt and suddenly just goes to drink. His life has no more meaning, because it seems like he has no wife, has no children, and the one purpose in his life is now gone, and he's just rudderless. And I love those scenes that he does, because some of it's just a simple hand motion, it's just a simple body language. You see him in the background, the broken man who will never, ever be repaired until the very end of his existence, when he finally starts to find a purpose, and that's when he gets a visit in the night. He just owns the screen. And I saw his face and I was like, he's so familiar. And you, of course, brought it up before I could. I love Clash of the Titans and playing Poseidon like he did. And I just enjoyed that movie so much, and still to this day. And so, and him being a part of it, I cherish his work.
That is beautifully put, Steve. When you began, I thought you were going to pinpoint my exact favorite scene. You haven't exactly, you've talked around it, but it enables me to go into it in a little bit more detail. But before I do, yeah. Completely agree with everything you've said. His very distinctive face and characterization just makes him stick in your mind. In many ways, he kind of saves this film. He's obviously an extremely capable actor, and the particular scene where that really came home to me, as usual for you and I, it's a quiet, character-driven scene, and it's when John Bray, who is by now aware that he's having his fiancée romanced away from him, but he's too politely English to say anything about it, is instead trying to discover more about the amulet. And he's with Sir Giles, and Sir Giles is sitting by the fire, drinking, wallowing in self-pity, slurring. And when he comes over to the table and he groggily knocks his glass over onto Bray's work, the younger man explodes with, "You drunken, clumsy oaf!" And there's this shocked silence and the look of hurt on Sir Giles's suddenly sobered up face really, really gets you. And it makes Bray instantly regret it. And the older man's attempt to pull together and recover some of his self-respect and leave the room with quiet dignity, it's heartbreaking, really. So it's a memorable character scene in a film which unfortunately doesn't have that many of them.
I agree with you. That's a memorable scene. And even early on, when he's finding out from the American King, Mr. King, you know, Fred Clark, they're going to take it on tour and change all these plans. And you can see how he's like, what are you doing? And he ends up suffering all the flack, the fallout from it, even though he had no control because he wasn't funding the expedition and all the other stuff. He was totally blindsided. You know, Bay, George Pastel's character, he's right there in the room when it happens. I got to give him like, really, dude, you're blaming the Egyptologist for doing this when you were right there and you knew he didn't want that to happen. And it was totally blindsided also. It almost reminded me of like a Hallmark movie moment where the couple suddenly fight and you're looking at like, you're fighting over what? And now suddenly you're like, really? This is what it is? It was like one of those moments. So a Hallmark moment in a Hammer movie. Who would have thunk it? But
who would have thunk it? Exactly.
When you first realize he's inebriated, is on the ship, and you knew right away when he took those first few steps. It was just amazing body acting and how it's like, wait a minute, he's drunk. He's bombed. And it that's within just a second or two.
It isn't overstated. It's not comical. It's not heavy-handed. He does just enough for you to be aware. And I think it's because Sir Giles was a reasonably dignified, well-respected man. And it only takes a subtle change for you to realize that there's something wrong.
But I'm curious, Alex, what merchandise tie-ins do you have for this movie?
All right, Steve, I'm so glad you asked because it enables me to pull off my dusty bookshelf once again, the Hammer Horror Omnibus from Pan Books. Now, people are probably thinking, how many films is he going to keep linking to these books? Well, the answer is, in terms of this first volume, only one more film, and that is The Gorgon. As I mentioned before, The Curse of the Mummy's Tomb was released as a supporting feature for The Gorgon. So that links those two stories, which is why they're in this book. The other two films in this book are The Curse of Frankenstein and The Revenge of Frankenstein, both of which we've covered. But what I wanted to do, as I've done before, is just read a little bit of John Burke's adaptation of The Curse of the Mummy's Tomb. As expected, he makes it sound like a very exciting film. But to be fair, what I'm going to read is also a very exciting sequence. In fact, this was my second choice for my favorite scene in the film. And I think this is done so well that it's almost like it's been dropped in from another slightly better film. But anyway, here we go. Alexander King stopped on a corner, baffled. Still doubts and speculations jangled in his mind. Maybe the publicity would be a good thing. Crowds would flock into the exhibition if the mummy came back. He tried to make himself concentrate on his route. There was no street name on the wall above him. He crossed the road to where an archway opened onto what might be Mews. As he came closer, he heard the faint lapping of water, and there was a sudden mournful groan from a ship's foghorn. He must be close to the river. It was incredible that he should have walked so far in the wrong direction. King hesitated, then turned back. Another archway swam out of the fog. It was growing thicker here, mingling with the river mist and producing strange shapes of the shifting darkness. There was an almost solid shape framed in the archway. As he drew level, King found that the shape did not dissolve into wisps of fog. It remained substantial, the figure of a man, motionless, apparently waiting for him. I'm going to stop there because anyone who's seen the film knows what happens next, and it's definitely one of the best scenes in the film. I thought that passage really built it up beautifully.
Well, I think so too. Definitely it was one of the better scenes of the movie. It was one of the few times the setting, and unlike most Hammer films that I've seen, this one seemed to be a lesser quality. I mean, maybe the money wasn't there, but like, I think I might be judging a little harsher because the mummy doesn't, as you already brought up, so eloquently doesn't look as good.
I suspect that you're right, that the money did have a lot to do with it, which means that Michael Carreras did actually do an amazing job pulling everything together and making it look as good as it did. But in this particular sequence, without once again giving too much away, even the stunt work is amazingly good at the climax of that sequence. And that's something that doesn't always happen, but from the very, very quiet, ominous build-up to what actually happens to poor old Alexander King, really beautifully done.
Oh, I agree.
Did you want to give your final thoughts?
Sure. This is an interesting film, as we already discussed. There are some moments in it that are just splendidly acted and done, and then there's other parts that are just contrived scenes that are put together and acted fine, but not to the level that we're used to seeing in a lot of these Hammer movies. The love triangle that comes so quickly between the main leads. The end scene, I know we talked about the thing where she's rescued by the militia or whatever, the armed militia coming. Well, technically, she was already safe at the whole point they showed up. It was kind of anticlimactic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like, she's fine at that point because it's all taken care of. So the ending was kind of a downer, but I think to me, the main negative of the movie is the pacing in the first 50 some odd minutes of the movie. It just takes a long time to get to where it's going. And you had the kill earlier of Michael Ripper's character, but I don't know if that was the mummy or if he died from some other. It's very ambiguous how he died because of what happens later in the movie.
I think it was a toxic reaction to the brown face makeup that he was forced to wear in that role.
Well, I was going to say, if only they had him eating dates, then we could have used an Indiana Raiders of the Lost Ark, but he had some bad dates.
Bad dates.
But, you know, he wasn't eating nose because he had it right there in his mouth. So maybe it was an allergic reaction. I don't know. But it was just
maybe
the mummy wouldn't have been revived at that point because the character that did the reviving didn't have the object to do the reviving until later in the movie.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. And if you had actually taken my scene and I had talked about Alexander King's death, I was going to mention exactly what you've just said. It happens over 50 minutes into the film, which, I'm sorry, that's way too long to have to wait.
Especially for a movie that's 79 minutes. So really, it's like the last 25 minutes is when all the action, so to speak, happens. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the few times I've actually looked at the clock when I was watching it on the Blu-ray. I'm
like, yeah, hey,
I got to be around the hour mark. And I'm looking at it like, 55 minutes. Like, it's got to pick it up. You know, I like slow burns. I know you love slow burns, but there was nothing really happening to make this a slow burn. I mean, do I dislike watching a movie? No, it was fun to watch, but it goes back to you have to see the lesser quality ones with the better quality ones. Like we talked about last week, we talked about Twins of Evil, which is like stellar. Mm-hmm. To go from Twins of Evil to this is kind of jarring in some ways. Mm-hmm. And we've had some interesting highs and lows in the last few months.
We sure have. This film, it's not bad. It's just dull. And maybe that's worse than being bad, but it's Hammer. And for that reason alone, it's still a film that I'm happy to invest my time in. But it also makes me think of Teflon. Nothing sticks, making this one of the films that I've had to watch the most for this podcast, because every time I watched it, I'd get to the end and nothing seemed to leave any lasting impression. Now, maybe that's just me. None of us are getting any younger. It makes me sad, and I think it's obvious now why I wanted to do the third Mummy movie from Hammer before we did this one. But even so, Steve, I think we've still managed to tease out some good aspects of this film.
There's one thing I want to say. There's one good thing I liked about the movie, and that's Fred Clark as the American entrepreneur.
Yes, of course.
I mean, it was obviously, you know, one note character, but he played it well, and he was just driven to make the buck. You know, it reminded me of the old King Kong movie. We're going to make a killing, boys. We're all going to be rich. So I love that type of character, and he did it very, very well. So I want to give him credit. His character and the professor's character are the two I really remember the most.
Yeah, exactly. As I say, he was in my reserve favorite scene, and when that scene begins, he actually does something which makes you feel sympathetic towards him. It actually suddenly expands his character out and makes him much more likable in the last few moments of his life. But hey, isn't that always the way? Anyway, Steve.
Yeah, that's always the way, you know. Well, maybe it's one last good deed before you go find out what the final answer is.
Exactly. Our last good deed might be to have been kind to this film.
Let's roll the die to see what movie we'll be talking about next month. I just want to remind everybody what the six categories are. Number one, Dracula. Number two, Frankenstein. Number three, The Mummy. Number four is what, Alistair?
Science fiction.
Number five,
prehistoric.
And number six, your favorite one,
the experimental 1970s.
And listeners, I just rolled number four. We're going back to science fiction for the first time in a long time.
To infinity and beyond.
And Alistair, what movie are we going to do? Last time we did it was Quatermass in the Pit. That's been, for listeners, that was a long time ago. Go back and listen to it. It's a very good episode. Very good movie.
Absolutely. And I think it's probably a good idea to rejoin Professor Q. So let's go right back to the beginning and do his first film, The Quatermass Experiment.
Ooh, The Quatermass Experiment. I'm looking forward to it. Oh, I can't wait to get the Blu-ray out now.
And, you know, having just done a film that features a brash American, it will be interesting to now watch Brian Don Levy as Bernard Quatermass.
That is true. That is true. And then comparing him to the Quatermass that we saw in Quatermass in the Pit.
Sure, because as I've mentioned, and here comes the plug, as I've mentioned in my book, Infogothic, an unauthorized graphic guide to Hammer Horror. There have been a vast number of Quatermasses or Quatermassi, whatever the plural might be.
One day we'll have to start the Quatermass podcast.
The Quatercast.
We didn't do this last episode when we planned on episode 15 because we had the wonderful Judy Matheson joining us. Episode 16, which is this episode, we're going to give our revised top 10 list. Okay, so listeners, I'm going to go in reverse order, working from 10 to 1. And again, this is just our personal preferences. We're not saying that they're the best for everybody because Alistair's on my list. It's not going to match up. I'm sure it didn't match up last time. Number 10 for me, Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde. All they got to do is say Martine, and everybody knows why. Yes.
Absolutely.
Number 9, Revenge of Frankenstein, movies we did more recently. Number 8, Dracula Has Risen from the Grave. Number 7, I still like this one a lot, even though a lot of people had discomfort with it, The Lodge. Fine with those type of films. I know it's a hard film to watch, but I enjoy it and for what it brings. Number 6, Dracula, Prince of Darkness. Number 5, The Curse of Frankenstein. Number 4, the one, the only, The Mummy. Number 3, Twins of Evil. Number 2, Quatermass in the Pit. Again, I'm a sci-fi lover, so it's right up there with me, so I'm really looking forward to this next movie. And number 1 still, for me, Dracula. Will it stay number 1 all the way through? I don't know, but it'll be interesting to see.
That is fascinating, Steve. For two people who usually spend most of their episode agreeing with each other, we only had 2 snaps in that entire list. I'm finding this increasingly difficult now that we've done 16 films to actually distill them down into my top 10. And I really struggled, and I still think that this list I've ended up with is likely to change. Maybe even today I'll begin. Number 10, Quatermass and the Pit. A pit stop with Professor Q. This is an amazing film, but Hammer sci-fi will always take a backseat to horror for me. Amazing film. I really wish I could put it higher.
Well, you can, you know. It's your list.
Well, that's true. Thanks, Steve.
You're welcome.
Number 9, Dr. Jekyll and Sister Hyde. Love Potion number 9. Beswick and Bates ensure that this film will probably always find a place on my top 10. Number 8, Dracula, Prince of Darkness. Oh. Not my favorite Dracula, but it is actually one that I enjoy more every time I see it. And as we've found out from various people that we know online, Steve, it seems to have a much bigger following than we realized. Number 7, The Revenge of Frankenstein. Its heart and brains are definitely in the right place, and Cushing excels as the returning Baron. Of course he does. Great film, but as I've mentioned before, the Frankenstein series isn't necessarily where I'll go to first, although, having said that, we do have some amazing films in that cycle coming up. Number 6, Dracula Has Risen from the Grave. For me, this is the epitome of the fairy tale for adults ethos of Hammer, and I just think visually it's revolutionary. Number 5, The Vampire Lovers. Vampsploitation in a powerhouse performance from Ingrid Pitt. This is still the most faithful adaptation of Sheridan Le Fanu's Carmilla, and I'll always love it. Number 4, The Curse of Frankenstein. This is the governor of Hammer Horror, but putting it at number 4 feels more like I'm paying my respects rather than acknowledging a personal favorite. It is supremely important in the history of Hammer Horror, but as I say, I respect more than love it. Number 3, a new entry. You might be able to guess what this is going to be, Steve. Twins of Evil. This film literally gets better with every viewing, and I think it's possibly Hammer's greatest 1970s film. Come at me, bro, anyone who disagrees, but, you know, I might change my mind as well. Let's see. Number 2 is a mummy film, but not the mummy film we've just done. The Mummy, the only mummy that anybody needs. 1959's The Mummy, pure class. Number one, bracket, horror of bracket, Dracula. I don't see anything dislodging the count from the top of my list. This is the film which established Christopher Lee and perfected the Hammer horror brand. Unassailable.
And listeners, as always, we love to have feedback. Send us your list. What do you think, out of the 16 movies that we've done so far, how would you rank them in your top 10 order? You can send it to us at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com. You can put it on Facebook as a comment to this post, or you could do a voicemail like some people have done in the past, share that too. So I'm curious where everybody else puts these films.
I would absolutely love to see other people's lists, and I'd love to hear from those rabid fans of The Curse of the Mummy's Tomb who want to take us apart for not being kinder to their favorite movie. So we'd love to see your list.
And now I enjoyed having this time again to talk with you.
Always fun. All right, everyone. We're looking forward to having you join us next time for a film which in many ways is as important to Hammer Horror as The Curse of Frankenstein. The very first time that we see Professor Q, the Quatermass Experiment.
Hammerama is a proud part of the Diecast Movie Podcast.